good afternoon, one and all, especially you, Ted, for making it back on time. The session wouldn't be quite the same without you, so glad you got back.
Need somebody to pick on.
That's it. And Dana Lynn told me that I couldn't pick on her again today. So.
Does she ever stand for shirt on?
No, she doesn't. But she got hold of me a couple minutes ago and said, "Don't do that again." So I promised her I'd leave her alone. For those of you who don't know, I'm Charles Lane, and today's session is entitled "The Living Earth." Earth cycles. And this week I've been trying to work on kind of a consciousness raising of sorts with respect to the interdependent nature of different kinds of things that have to do with living on this sphere that is our planet, our home. And the first session that we had a couple times back was entitled "The Seven Spheres," in which I broke down things like the atmosphere and the lithosphere and the hydrosphere and some more into distinct entities on the basis of spheres, thinking in terms of spheres, to kind of get our mind working in a particular way. And I followed that up last time with a discussion on what I called Earth circles. Circles and spheres tend to go together in a certain fashion. And we actually had some discussions. Too bad you weren't here, Mel. You would have enjoyed this. I actually took them through in no more than about 5 minutes' time. I took them clear through non-Euclidean geometry.
Practicing mathematics without a license.
That's it, exactly. I was practicing mathematics without a license.
We'll get you for that.
And all of my mathematics friends give me a very hard time about how I'm a wannabe mathematician and practicing math without a license. But I was sort of pleased with myself for taking them all the way through non-Euclidean geometry in 5 minutes.
No, I should have been here.
No math teacher would ever try to do that. That's right. But the idea there was principally to talk about how energy, in fact, is transferred across the face of a sphere in circular fashions. And we've talked about the Coriolis effect. And you all have seen it because you've watched the television news every night, watched the local weather station. You've seen those low and high pressure systems swirling around in a circle. That's not by accident. That's because we have a transfer of energy across the surface of the sphere. And when you try to have energy, in this case heat energy, transferred from the equatorial areas to the poles, and you try to do that against the motion of a circling sphere or a spinning sphere, then circles are what are the result. And those circles explain, among other things, in the broader context of what we're talking about this week, interdependence of everything with the Earth's atmosphere and some of the problems that we're addressing with respect to global warming. Here's the book we've been working at and that Mark has been so anxiously paging through. We finished up by pointing out that those circles are what circulate, among other things, chlorofluorocarbons into the high stratosphere above the poles. And also circulate unnatural types of things such as lead from leaded gasolines over the years onto the ice fields of places like Greenland and Antarctica.
Could you clarify one small point? If this gets you off track, then don't answer it. But
my students try to do this intentionally to get me off track.
Could we take the ozone in Los Angeles's pollution and export it to the stratosphere and solve two problems at once?
Now, do you consider yourself a very clever fellow for thinking that up?
Sure, the question's been asked many times. You have the answer.
He got it on Newsweek too.
Yeah,
actually, that has been suggested on a number of occasions by a number of different people, and I think the first one was actually a Soviet climatologist who was talking about that. Last time we also talked a little bit about greenhouse gases and how they come in threes. And we talked about water vapor and carbon dioxide and ozone, which is O3. The difference between O2 and O3 is everything. O2 is transparent to radiation that comes from the sun. It's transparent to radiation that goes back from the Earth's surface back out into space. O3, and really anything that's composed of three molecules, is different. Ozone in the stratosphere at great height is very good because that's what blocks ultraviolet radiation and makes the world a safer place for people who have skin tones like mine. Ozone down in the troposphere at the very bottom of the atmosphere, as in Los Angeles. Of course, the joke around Los Angeles is, what can you see on a clear day in Los Angeles? UCLA. I went to UCLA, so that's why. But in the troposphere, it's a very bad thing because it's part of that whole photochemical smog process, and you don't want it down there. So there has been some suggestion about, let's take the ozone that is down here in the troposphere and try to put it into the stratosphere, and in essence plug the ozone hole. And it's a fine sort of idea. There's lots of problems in trying to pull something like that off. And, you know, first and foremost is it's not addressing any kind of fundamental change in our behavior in the first place. So, but it has been thought of, and actually a number of years back. Okay, so we didn't get too far off of that. All right, now, that's to kind of bring some of you who've not been in on this a little bit up to speed in terms of what we're up to today. Now, today, though, it's business of what I'm calling Earth cycles. One of the most important and most difficult pursuits across the spectrum of scientific endeavors is working with cycles and working even in trying to identify cycles. Every now and then, one of them jumps up and just starts slapping us back and forth across the face and becomes something that you're going, my gosh, what is going on here? Why haven't I seen this before? But I want to continue the discussion today with the business of how things can cycle. And if you are a geochemist, you talk about geochemical cycles, and if you're a biologist, and deferring to geochemists, you talk about biogeochemical cycles. But an amazing number of things cycle, and they cycle on different scales. We'll be talking about the carbon cycle today on a certain scale, and tomorrow on a different one, as a matter of fact. But lots of things cycle. They reside here for a while, they reside here for a while, they reside there for a while, and then they go back to where they started from. And in terms of understanding what goes on in the world around us and the environment around us, it's absolutely crucial to get a handle on cycles. Some geochemists talk about cycling different of the elements: oxygen, carbon, sulfur, phosphorus, nitrogen, all of these kinds of things. We can also talk about cycling trace metals, as a matter of fact. We sort of like to have them tied up in the ground below us. And we sort of like the idea that most plants don't take up trace metals through their root systems. Unfortunately, Gulf Coast shrimp pick up lots of trace metals, concentrate them in their tissues, and I don't go to the Gulf Coast seafood places as often as I used to. Okay, so the concept of cycles and residence times in cycles is terribly, terribly important. What I'm going to do is start off just kind of give you an idea with a cycle that I work with all the time, very familiar with, and you too. It's more of a geologic, broader geologic kind of cycle than some of the things we've been talking about, and that is the hydrologic cycle. And for whatever reason, since I started off with blue on the mountains, I'll make it sea green. And put a little boat out here. This is Ted. when he's not in the Sierra Nevada, he's off sailing San Francisco Bay. Sierra Nevada, California, coastal plain area, Pacific Ocean out here. And I would suggest most of you had some introduction to the hydrologic cycle somewhere along the line. The nice Pacific sea breeze comes blowing over the top of the water's surface, does to the surface of the ocean what it does to you when you're out in the wind. You're out in the wind all day. Dana Lynn goes home at night. She hauls out the, what do you haul out? You haul out Jergens.
Actually, yeah.
You do. So you're not an oil of lay sort of person, are you? All right, so you haul out the Jergens. You put it all over your face because you've been dried out, right? Well, when you dry out the surface of the ocean, you are evaporating water off the surface of the ocean. And so here we have evaporation off the surface of the ocean. Gets up high enough, you get condensation into a cloud. Prevailing sea breeze blows this up against the side of the Sierra Nevada, where it rains. So now the cloud is moving over here. Precipitation is falling on the side of the Sierra Nevada. We have precip precipitation. And of course the water then runs back down the side of the Sierra Nevada, comes back this way and into the ocean as runoff. They even taught you this in biology, didn't they, Dan?
Somewhere.
Child care.
Right. And the cycle is completed, right? Very, very straightforward, simple kind of an idea, the hydrologic cycle. Okay. And fortunately for us, when we start talking about residence times of water in any place along this cycle, yeah, the residence time here may be fairly lengthy in the world's oceans, but the residence time in the atmosphere, fortunately, is fairly short. You know, the water up there doesn't do us a lot of good up there. We need to have it back down here where we can use it. So residence times are fairly short in the atmosphere. They can be fairly short as this water runs back off the land to the ocean. Be longer, obviously, if we're talking about the Mississippi River system and draining the entire continent. They can be longer yet if some of this water actually infiltrates into the ground and becomes stored as groundwater, because water moving down the stream moves with great speed. Water moving underground through pores and openings in the rock and soil doesn't move with much speed at all. This actually is kind of an important concept for us, the differences in residence time. What happens if we have some type of environmental spill up in this area, whatever it is, load of pesticides, 2,4-D or something like that, is accidentally dumped into the stream course? The residence time in the stream course becomes kind of an important consideration for us, because if we're depending on that water for our water supply, we want it to move out of there just as quickly as possible. I mean, everybody is going to have their problem as this thing comes downstream in a slug, that kind of thing. But the stuff is confined to the water is confined to the water course, and stuff passes us by and we get the thing flushed with new water behind it, and its residence time is not very long, and we're feeling a whole lot better. Now, of course, if this is a continuing event, that's something else again. But you see, if it's a one-time event, and the contamination is not put into the stream course, but instead is put into the groundwater, that is a completely different situation. That's a totally different situation, because the groundwater moves so much more slowly down this way, ultimately to the sea, that it may have a residence time of years and years and years and years and years, 10 years, 100 years, 200 years, in the groundwater, where it had virtually no residence time, a day, a half a day, 2 hours in the stream. If you're dependent upon the stream for your municipal water supply, okay, let's let this thing go by. If you're dependent upon the groundwater here for your municipal water supply, you have a completely different type of problem on your hands. That's why the protection of groundwater resources is so extraordinarily important, because you don't have the margin for error that you have if you're dealing with a stream, a surface water course of some kind. So the scientific community is extraordinarily interested in residence times, how long something is going to stick around in a certain area. Okay? There are lots and lots and lots and lots of different cycles, this just being an example. Take an intro geology class and we talk about the rock cycle and we talk about the tectonic cycle. If you're a seawater chemist, you talk about how long different ions actually reside in the seawater before they perhaps go down the bottom and become incorporated in the sediment. Residence times, extraordinarily important. In the case of groundwater, we don't want anything in there because it's going to stay there for a long time. If we're talking about trace metals getting a cumulative toxic poisoning, systematic lead poisoning or mercury poisoning or something like that, we want that to have a long residence time in a certain part of the cycle. We want it to have a long residence time in the lithosphere, in the soils, because by and large, plants do not take it up. We want it to have a very short residence time, which is not the case, unfortunately, on the Texas Gulf Coast. We want to have a very short residence time in those estuarine environments, those estuaries on the Texas Gulf Coast, because then they get into the shrimp and the oysters and all this sort of stuff. And we don't want a long residence time for mercury in us. Okay, so the residence time and where it is, terribly important. Okay, anything there for kind of go on. I don't want to beat any one thing to death here, but I do want to kind of bring the point across. Anybody with a question on this? Okay. Now, another concept that has been in the science realm for a very long time and is starting to make its presence felt in a lot more human endeavors, concept of loops and subloops, and you've sometimes heard them referred to as feedback loops. Okay? I'll take a moment just to talk about feedback loops, because they are also some of the more difficult things that science is trying to work with. And we work with what we call negative feedback loops, and we also work with what we call positive feedback loops. And now we're going to get to a point where we can address one of Mark's favorite topics here in just a moment. We're going to switch gears just a little bit. We're going to switch gears and move on out away from the hydrologic cycle. Oh, let me do one other thing real quick on the hydrologic cycle while it comes to my head. This concept of residence time in the hydrologic cycle is also very important, not just on an issue of contamination, but on an issue of resource. If you get your water supply from a river that runs by, and you need X amount of water, then you need so much water running through the river so you can pull it out of there. That's a fairly easy thing to see and to quantify. When you try to get your groundwater, your water out of the ground, then that whole quantification process is much more difficult. And you need to think a little bit about residence times, because if you want to have a sustainable water source from a groundwater reservoir, you don't want to take out any more water than what comes in to the groundwater basin. The American West is full of horror stories on this account because it's so hard to quantify, and that water is out of sight and out of mind down there below you, that people just don't tend to think about it. And so you draw groundwater tables down lower and lower and lower and lower, and just, you know, don't even begin to think about some of the problems that you have. Mexico City drops the groundwater table underneath Mexico City about 11 feet a year. So this year it's 11 feet lower than what it was last year. Next year it'll be 11 feet more. There is no thought to the residence time of water in there and trying to establish a sustainable water use. So again, residence time is extraordinarily important concept in a lot of areas people never heard about, just never given a whole lot of thought to. There are going to be some very serious problems in the American West in just a handful of years, I think, with respect to just that issue, not paying attention to a groundwater budget. That's the last thing I want to throw in on that. All right, now, good feedback loops. And now let's kind of move out of my hydrogeologic example and move up into more of what we're talking about this week, the business of problems of global warming. And again, those of you who were not here the last time or two, one of the things we did is we identified the different types of greenhouse gases, how they behaved, how natural or unnatural they were, these kinds of things. One of the arguments that's often presented about let's not worry so much about global warming has to do with the formation of clouds and the fact that the formation of clouds will in fact cool the Earth's atmosphere. And what that is a feedback loop. What it is it's a feedback loop, and it works something like this. If I've got, now switch back to blue, I've got the surface of the ocean out here, and Ted's sailing along in his boat. The idea works like this. Atmospheric temperatures warm up. Atmospheric temperatures warm up. Increases the rate of evaporation of water off the surface of the ocean. Okay, now water vapor is a greenhouse gas. Okay? Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. It does not allow Earth's radiant heat energy to escape back into space. But if you get the formation of clouds, the idea is formation of clouds will in and of themselves not allow sunshine to come down, heat up the surface of the ocean. And it's a cooling mechanism. It's a negative feedback loop, and it works. It has worked in the past. Those of you who have spent any time with me the last couple of weeks, 2 weeks ago we were talking about volcanoes and glaciers and this sort of stuff, but on a couple of occasions talked about, and Mark will tell you that I have this sort of interest in history as well as mathematics. On a couple of occasions I talked about Mount Tambora, which exploded in Indonesia back in 1815 and produced the year without a summer in 1816. Which some historians will tell you led to the fall of a great many European nations and contributed to revolutionary fervor. How about that, Ted? Speaking of climate controlled effects on civilization. And created the exodus of Maine and Vermont farmers farther south into Pennsylvania and Virginia to try and escape the winters. And also, by the way, kicked off the Farmer's Almanac. Farmer's Almanac got kicked off, and this, speaking of fortuitous, the Farmer's Almanac for 1816, via a typographical error, it was unintentional, but via typographical error, predicted snow in New England in July, which is exactly what happened. And it was, well, the Farmer's Almanac can call that. Well, I'm going to start paying attention to this stuff. Okay, that's what made the Farmer's Almanac. As a matter of fact, Mount Tambora blowing up in Indonesia made the Farmer's Almanac. But what it did, is it kicked out a great cloud of sulfur dioxide, which combined with water vapor in the air, which there was plenty at the equator, which is where the volcano was in Indonesia. All right, now here's Dana Lynn's question. If you take sulfur dioxide and water vapor, if you take SO2 and H2O and put the two of them together, what do you end up with?
Sulfuric acid.
You end up with sulfuric acid. And basically the planet had a great deal of sulfuric acid in liquid form as clouds for the next year or so. And as it turns out, sulfuric acid in liquid form and clouds high up in the atmosphere, a fantastically reflective medium with respect to sunlight. Reflected the sunlight away, cooled the atmosphere, cooled the planet. You had 1816, the year without a summer, as a result of that. Okay, so it's been shown to work. All right. Now, will it necessarily?
Some people say we should burn more high sulfur coal so we get more sulfur in the air to make more clouds.
That is exactly correct. Now, the flip side of that is
acid rain,
and there was an increase of acid rain and reports of disruption of flora and fauna in the mid-latitude regions. Of course, that's where people were paying attention to those kinds of things for a few years after the eruption, after all this sulfuric acid actually came back down out of the air. But there has been some suggestions that we actually burn more high sulfur coal in order to accomplish just that. That doesn't take into account that the coal itself has a lot of carbon in it, and it's principally carbon, and you're going to put more carbon dioxide in here as well. But that's actually been a suggestion. The deal here, though, is that the climatic modeling that's been done would indicate to us that low-level clouds like this may not do as much good as what we had thought, and that if you have a bunch of low-level clouds here like this, you may have a situation akin to what many of us had when we were growing up. Since we don't have the video arcade games anymore, we used to play the pinball games, right? You used to play the pinball games, and the great thing is when you get the pinball bouncing back and forth between different things and racking up points. And if that happens with the electromagnetic radiation, just trying to get out of the atmosphere, just trapped underneath the clouds and bouncing back and forth. So the idea is that it's a negative feedback loop, that it counters what is going on. If the atmospheric temperatures are warming up, this is something that's supposed to cool it. That's the idea. Whether that's actually the case here or not is something else again. Alright? The negative feedback loop is the idea. Now, here's the one that Mark enjoyed, and you guys will enjoy this as well. Positive feedback loop is anything that tends to enhance what is going on. So if we're working on atmospheric warming and we do something that enhances it even further, that's a positive feedback loop. Okay. All right. Now, we come out of, I guess I'll use the orange for surface. We come out of the great northern coniferous forests of Canada and Siberia, and we break out of these things up fairly close to the Arctic Ocean, and out here is the Great Northern Tundra. The effects of global warming are actually, the measured effects of global warming actually are greater at the poles than at the equator. If we have about half a degree centigrade in the last few years at the equator, we've had a full degree centigrade up toward the poles. You have global warming in the poles area. Let's forget about all the ice and all this sort of stuff. But if you have global warming in the pole areas, here in the tundra lies a great deal of decayed, rotted flora, all of the flora of the tundra, that basically is locked up in the ground, in that at least semi-frozen area, frozen parts of the earth, and that decayed, rotting flora is holding a great deal of
methane.
Okay. I'm going to play chemist again because I enjoy this so much. But methane is a molecule that looks like this, the formula for which is CH4, swamp gas. There's a great amount of methane that is tied up in the tundras of Canada and Siberia. Back to this business of residence time again. Methane has been tied up here in the tundra for a very long time. We would like it to stay there, obviously, because as a 5-atomic type of molecule, it actually is a much more effective greenhouse gas than even water vapor or carbon dioxide. One of the fastest rising in terms of its concentration of any of the greenhouse gases. And we're sort of wondering why that is. Why that is. Why is methane such a fast rising gas? But we'll come to that in just a sec. The idea is that we want this stuff to stay locked up here in the tundra. But if you have global warming that warms the tundra, thaws the ground, you have the potential for methane that is locked up in the tundra to go rising up into the atmosphere, becoming a greenhouse gas, and positively affecting the process. Positively affecting the process. You have a positive feedback loop. This is right where atmospheric scientists and really all Earth scientists who study the problem are right now. What are the feedback loops? What are they? What are they doing? What's their effect on us? Okay. There's a couple of odd things that have come up as a result of this. Okay? Now, stay with me as we head farther south. We're going to touch on all kinds of things today. Let's go farther south and talk a little bit, instead of the northern taiga, the great coniferous forests of Canada and Siberia, let's go down to the equator and talk about the tropical rainforest. Okay, now there's stuff that we all know a little bit about, read quite a bit about, hear a number of things about. Let me tell you a couple of feedback loops that are at work down here that are kind of strange. Okay, one of them has to do with the fact that trees in the tropical rainforest generate their own clouds. Think about the hydrologic cycle. We evaporated water off the Pacific Ocean around Ted's boat, right? Evaporated water off the Pacific and formed the clouds by condensation. Scientific community has calculated that there is more fresh water stored in the tropical rainforests than in all of the world's freshwater reservoirs, the Great Lakes, Lake Baikal. All the lakes of the world, there is more water, actually fresh water, actually stored in the tropical rainforest. Rent yourself a Cessna and a pilot if you don't fly it yourself. Rent yourself a Cessna next time you're in Brazil. Take to the air and watch clouds forming magically right out of the air over the top of the rainforest. In the case of plants, transpiration, right? Ms. Biologist?
That's good.
Transpiration, plants sweating, plants giving off water. The plants give off the water, the trees give off the water, and the clouds form. The clouds form. What do you suppose then happens once you clear cut the tropical rainforest? Drought ensues. You've changed the climate. You've modified the climate. Now, it doesn't happen fast enough. It doesn't happen fast enough to prevent something else that you don't want. right after you get through clear cutting the forest, you get one last good rain, basically, and of course the forest is clear cutted, so all the topsoil washes in the Amazon. Okay? But then you get a drought that ensues. Every last one of you have paid attention for what? Nearly two decades now with respect to the Ethiopian famine, right? Some of you may have actually contributed money, been involved with care projects with respect to the Ethiopian famine. Are you aware that it was approximately two decades ago that Ethiopia got on its horse and started clear-cutting all of its forests? Ethiopia, two decades ago, had approximately 40% of its land surface covered by forests. It now has less than 1% of its land surface covered by forests. One of the real ironic things that happened in the middle of all of this that didn't make a whole lot of news, one of the really ironic things that happened in the middle of all of this was that there was a Brazilian delegation that went to Ethiopia to complain about Ethiopia clear-cutting their rainforests. Any idea why a Brazilian delegation would go complain to Ethiopia?
Economic?
Oh, it was terribly economic. I mean, that's a good safe answer, too.
Yeah, I mean, they by clear-cutting their forests, they were cutting into Brazil's wood.
Not that's not the economic fashion that you might imagine. Brings us to another point, though, and I'm just going to dance on this, but I want to bring it out because it's just another example of how everything is so interdependent, all right? Now, the latest thing, of course, is Rio, right? The latest thing is Rio, and everything went on down there, and the big issue was biodiversity, right? And that, I may try something with that next week, as a matter of fact, but the big thing was biodiversity. As it turns out, if you're into especially botany and botanical resources, there is a school of thought that holds that there are only like 10 or 12 resource centers for the entire globe for certain types of biota, floral biota, and that these absolutely must be preserved. And here's the example I'll give, and then I'll come back to the story of Ethiopia. You may not know it, but the World Rice Research Institute is in the Philippines. Okay? World Rice Research Institute is in the Philippines. The thing that they are interested in protecting is the genome for rice. Come back, do some things with you here. The genetic pool for rice is what they're interested in preserving. There are something like 47,000 different types of rice that the Rice Institute keeps track of. In the late 70s, there was a new blight that hit rice in Southeast Asia, all of Indochina, southern China, and there was the makings of a substantial population disaster there. And none of these 47,000 types of rice were going to stand up to the blight. So the Rice Institute went to a valley, the upper Indus River Valley, okay, Indian subcontinent area, and started casting around for native wild stands of rice. And here's where the biodiversity and wetlands, I mean, all of this is tied together. This is where the biodiversity wetlands type stuff came in, because in this upper Indus Valley, they found a wild strain of rice that was resistant to the blight. And then they went back and did some genetic engineering on this stuff and then started introducing new strain in Southeast Asia and basically staved off a famine. They found the wild rice, collected it, harvested, took it back to the Philippines to work with it. About 2 months before that particular valley in the upper Indus was flooded by a hydroelectric power project. This thing about biodiversity is a whole other thing in and of itself. But as far as the Brazilians were concerned, now to go back to the Ethiopian story, as far as the Brazilians were concerned, point of going to Ethiopia is that it is in the Ethiopian highlands that the world's wild strains for coffee are found. Now, when we think of coffee, good Lutherans and Episcopalians all, when we think of coffee, we're thinking about Brazil, Colombia, all this stuff in South America. But those folks look to Ethiopia for the gene pool. And clear-cutting the Ethiopian highlands and deforesting that had a direct economic impact. So yours was a good guess. A direct economic impact for Brazil. And so the Brazilians were on their way to Ethiopia to beg Ethiopia not to do this, because they were destroying one of the gene pool centers for coffee, as a matter of fact. So anyway, another feedback loop system, right? The drought sets in, so go back to the Amazon again. The rainforest would normally produce its own clouds, help the whole process with respect to hydrologic cycle. You clear cut the rainforest, the drought ensues. Now, let's come back to a positive feedback loop that you were wondering about. Mark was really wondering about this a few days ago. Is this business with methane for real? And the answer is yes, that it is. But you may have heard about U.S. government actually spending money for research on methane produced by cattle. Cattle produce methane from both ends. Okay. What is it that Brazil is clear-cutting the forest for? Running cattle to feed people. There's a positive feedback loop. I mean, there's several positive feedback loops. One is that the trees that have been felled are going to rot, and they're going to give up the carbon dioxide they contain. Two, the clear-cut land now is going to be used to try and graze cattle, which produce methane. And thirdly, and also methane generating, there has been a population explosion in the tropics with respect to termites because of all the felled lumber. Termites are just like cows in that respect. They are methane producing. The rate of methane increase is, the curve is steeper for methane than just about any of the other greenhouse gases. Where does it come from? It may come from cattle, may come from termites. Another place it gets generated is in landfills.
Can I ask a question backtracking, Gene? You talked about the methane that was contained in the tundra.
Right.
Now, what is the origin of that? I mean, I'm just thinking also when I think about this.
The other name is swamp gas, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so methane is generated in swampy areas. All right. That tundra you can actually think of as a swampy area during the wet or during the hot season, during the summer season. Okay. Actually, if you want to travel across the tundra with any amount of success, you want to go in the winter when it's frozen.
There is actually bacteria and stuff growing within the tundra during the wet season?
Yes.
Oh,
and it's a great northern swamp, if you will. And so the swamp gas is formed there just like in other places.
Okay.
So there's all these strange and bizarre and unusual feedback loops that come into play. And the challenge of the earth sciences is to actually try to identify all of these things and look at their effects individually and severally. And methane happens to be one of them. It's increasing at a dramatic rate, and we want to know why. And cattle and termites and landfills are one of the things that we're looking at.
Isn't rice also another big factor? Rice paddies?
The rice paddies themselves can be, sure. They're kind of swampy areas, and if you get a lot of biomass basically rotting in a paddy for some reason, why you can do that. But it's such an effective greenhouse gas that the earth scientists are kind of concerned about. course, now it can always oxidize, right? It gets into the atmosphere and it oxidizes. All right, Manlin, I'm sorry, but it's too much fun having you in here. Now, take this methane molecule, and if you oxidize it, what are you going to turn it into?
CO2.
CO2 is one. What's the other thing you're going to get?
And water.
H2O. I'll write these the way I wrote them the other day. Oops, I don't want to. I'll just do this one. Point being that those are triatomic molecules, if you will. Diatomic molecules, invisible to sunlight as it comes to the Earth's surface, invisible to infrared radiation, which comes back from the Earth's surface and back outer space. Diatomic molecules, O2, N2. Triatomic molecules, invisible to sunlight as it comes to the Earth's surface, but opaque with respect to infrared radiation as it comes back off the Earth's surface. And that's the greenhouse effect. So, yeah, after a while it oxidizes, but it oxidizes to other greenhouse gases. Okay. Anything else while we're on this line?
So it's invisible to radiant sun and it's opaque to...
Right. The thing of it is that sunlight comes in, is sort of like being in the dentist's office and having the x-ray taken. Mm-hmm. You know, your cheek is basically invisible to the x-ray, but that lead apron they put over you is opaque to it, which is why you wear it. Okay? So the shorter wavelength stuff that comes in as visible light comes right on through, but the Earth re-radiates the heat at a longer wavelength, the infrared, and it gets caught.
And those are triatomic?
No. Triatomic, they call them triads. Okay, a little easier to say than triatomic molecules. Okay, one last thing. I'm actually longer getting here than I want to, but let's try anyway. A day in the life of the forest. Now you'll like this because this is XY plot, straight out of math class.
I'm going to watch closely.
All of you can handle XY plots, right? You know, one axis up, one axis over. Day in the life of the forest. Early in the morning, before the sun comes up, CO2 level in the forest is very low. Okay? And this is time going off this way. Day in the life of the forest. Early in the morning, before the sun comes up, CO2 level is very low. That's because photosynthesis occurs during the daylight hours. Plants need the sun to make it work. CO2 level climbs during the daylight hours until about... I'm sorry. CO2 drops. Sorry, I turned that the other way. CO2 level, let me back up one step further. CO2 level is whatever it is as the sun comes up, okay? But as the plants start their photosynthetic process, they will take that CO2 level and they'll take it in, okay? So with respect to atmospheric CO2, CO2 is taken up by the plants, taken in. So the CO2 level drops during the day, okay? Mid-afternoon, plant's taking in all the CO2 it wants. Now, of course, what it's doing is making sugars, right? That's how it's feeding itself. And of course, we're just the lucky recipients of the byproduct. We won't call this industrial waste in this case, since the plant is giving off oxygen for us to use. But the plant really could care less, right? But by the middle of the afternoon, it's taking in all the CO2 it wants, right? Convert to sugar. Now it's chewing on the sugar. Okay, if I can sort of give it that animal quality, it's chewing on the sugar, and it's respiring. It's going through respiration now. So now the CO2 level in the atmosphere goes back up. Now this is something I think people miss out on a lot. They think that plants take in CO2, give off oxygen, and that's all there is to it. Plants take in CO2 during photosynthesis. and they will go ahead and give it back off during respiration as well. Okay? Oxygen really is just a byproduct, which we get our hands on, okay? And suits us just fine. So the CO2 level will turn and come back up. Well, for all of you remembering some basic math class, it looks a little bit like a waveform or a cycle or something like that that you may have studied in trigonometry, something like that. A cycle. You know, it cycles. The CO2 drops during the day when the sun is out, then the CO2 comes back up at night as the plant exhales. This plant exhales and gives off the carbon dioxide, so that back in the morning, kind of back to where we start from.
It's that means we should hike during the day when we have more oxygen?
Yeah, that's when the plant is giving off its most oxygen. Especially in this part of the world, that's when you should hike. You're watching these forests of the North Cascades breathe. You're watching them breathe. And you are watching the forests breathe every day. Every day. Let's think just a little bit further on this. You know that, as I turn the globe back upside down again to make the point, you know that the greatest land mass of the globe is not up here in the southern hemisphere, but down here in the northern hemisphere. You know that the greatest land masses of the globe are in the northern hemisphere. You know that springtime in the northern hemisphere is when the sun would be here, shining on the globe this way. And photosynthesis is going on in the northern hemisphere. Photosynthesis is going on in the northern hemisphere. In the spring, leaves are coming out, right? Photosynthetic process is going. You swing the globe around to the other side of the sun over here, where its most direct rays are coming in now, south of the equator. What's happening in the north? The leaves are falling off, falling to the floor of the forest, decaying. What is happening? CO2 is given off. There's another curve for CO2 against time. It's not a 24-hour curve, but a curve we could stretch out for years. And for every year, we would see an up in the spring, a down in the fall, an up in the spring, a down in the fall, an up in the spring, and a down in the fall. And on a yearly basis, we can watch the planet breathe. You see the planet breathe by looking at the record of the CO2. It's really kind of an amazing thought. Of course, James Lovelock took it and turned it into the Gaia hypothesis, that the planet really is alive. But you can watch the planet breathe. The problem is that the curve doesn't look like this. The curve looks like this. Because every year the CO2 level is increasing. We talk about first and second and third order phenomenon. The first order phenomenon here would be that we kind of take the midpoint on all of this stuff, we have a line that looks like this, which would reflect the CO2 level in the atmosphere increasing. The second order phenomenon would be the seasonal breathing of it. You see what else has happened here? If we make this about 1970 and we make this about 1990, 20-year period in here, you see what's happened to the amplitude of those curves? I mean, I didn't draw it this way by mistake. This was by design. You see the increase in amplitude of the curves? That's for real. Amplitude back down here in the 70s, peak to trough, may have been a change of, in the northern hemisphere, 6 or 7 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. By about 1990, the change in the amplitude was on the order of 20 parts per million from top to bottom. What this is heavy breathing. Now, I can think of various instances of heavy breathing, right? I am a very sick person. I can think of a couple of 18-year-olds parked in the car after the prom as an example of heavy breathing. But a different example of heavy breathing ought to come to all of you sitting here as you have hiked up and down the trails around here. Maybe we should say labored breathing. The planet's breathing, and it has become more labored over the past 20 years. If you want a good scientific answer as to why that is, I can't give it to you. And neither can anybody else that I know of. If photosynthesis and respiration, yin yang, half of each other, if they are out of balance, that might explain this. Photosynthesis is fundamentally controlled by light. If you don't have any light available, you don't have photosynthesis. It's secondarily controlled by amount of water that's available. You got to have water to pull in here to help make the sugars anyway. And thirdly, by the nutrients, the other nutrients that plants need to make them grow. So you got light, you got nutrients, you got water. Those things control photosynthesis. There's also three things that control respiration on the other end. And those are the same three things that control, or it's the same type of three things. That's what controls good real estate. What controls good real estate? Location, location, location. Take a wild guess. What controls respiration? Temperature, temperature, temperature. The best answer that that anybody has right now is that between the carbon dioxide increase and the temperature increase, the planet's breathing is becoming more and more labored. Why do you get the ships that look like this? But for feedback loops to try and get a handle on why is this? But it's an absolutely fascinating picture. It's a fascinating picture for what it tells you. It shows you a planet that's in trouble. Sort of like you're in trouble when you try to hike Holden and you're walking with somebody who's in better shape than you are. It gives the appearance of something that's working under a great load or with great labor.
I have a question. Where and how is that CO2 measured?
Actually, come back tomorrow, can you?
I am hiking Holden tomorrow. I don't know.
Well, come back. I'll probably touch a little bit on. Well, you'll be back by 6:45. Maybe. The question as to where and how the CO2 is measured. The CO2 is actually measured from a bunch of places around the world. And one of the things that I intend to talk about is Charles Keeling. This book talks about Charles Keeling to a great extent. The fellow at Caltech who first thought to measure atmospheric CO2 in the first place. But the things that will amaze you, or the one thing that will amaze you is the constancy in terms of the level of carbon dioxide globally, its extent through the atmosphere. If you want to take a mid-afternoon reading, of carbon dioxide levels at Point Barrow, Alaska, or Mauna Loa, Hawaii, or on the Ross Ice Shelf in Antarctica. Mid-afternoon reading will be the same from North Pole down toward the equator to South Pole. The atmospheric level will be the same.
It will be even though that the South Pole is in the fall while the North Pole is in the spring?
The levels will be the same, but the fluctuations up and down in terms of the heavy breathing will change. This heavy breathing is most indicative of the northern hemisphere. On the Ross Ice Shelf, there isn't any heavy breathing at all, but that's not where the breathing is going on. The breathing is going on where you have land mass for the plants to grow. That pretty much takes me to where I wanted to get this afternoon in terms of any sort of prepared remarks, and it's also 5 after 5, but if there's anything anybody wants to throw out for the good of the whole crowd.
Is there any clear relationship between the other billion or so people we added to the Earth in the last 20 years?
That's next week's series of lectures. Then we'll talk about Paul and Ann Ehrlich and population.
And why don't you have more pressure on the energy?
We'll talk about that next week, too, on some of the biodiversity.
I mean, really, compared to...